On a tablespoon of healthy soil, there can be more microbes than there are people on planet Earth. More than 8 billion microbes in a tablespoon of soil. And so there's this whole food web that happens in a healthy soil, and it's stimulated if we have grazing animals, if we have diverse plant communities growing on the soil. And so that's our challenge today in our modern era, where we have these big fields of corn and soybeans, of wheat and cotton. How do we, in some way, create something that's more like a prairie or a forest?
Welcome to Tangled Taproot, where we explore the unique stories of small-scale farmers in the Midwest. I am Jackson.
I'm John Cowan.
And I'm Kristen.
And this is a production of Milk and Hummus.
What's milk and hummus?
I'm glad you asked. We make flavorful hummus and a ready-to-drink plant-based latte that focuses on locally sourced ingredients, sustainable packaging, and the humble chickpea.
Joining us today is Dr. Rob Myers, Director of the Center for Regenerative Agriculture at the University of Missouri, a former USDA National Director of Sustainable Agriculture. Dr. Myers brings a wealth of knowledge about the historical and environmental forces shaping our soil health today. We'll explore how post-World War II farming practices transformed agriculture and the promise of regenerative methods like cover crops and the challenges farmers face today in adopting these new practices. Plus, we'll discuss the crucial role of government and independent farmers and gardeners in helping to make these changes a reality.
That's awesome. Yeah, we're really excited to be interviewing Dr. Myers. He really is connecting a lot of the dots for a lot of the scenarios farmers are experiencing currently in the Midwest, especially small-scale farmers, best practices, how to improve their yields, and really the unique science behind the soil microbiome and how that impacts production yields. Besides that, I mean, he has a really cool, unique background that we'll get to hear about. And
yeah, definitely worth staying tuned for dorky science people or also normal, passionate food listeners will also enjoy. And I think that a lot of us, whether we know much of anything about agriculture or farming, we probably have heard about either runoff or erosion or topsoil loss, just as general knowledge speak. And those are a couple of the primary hot topics that Dr. Myers is able to bring to the table to kind of help teach us a little bit more about.
In great detail.
Yeah. And he's also had some really unique roles throughout his tenure. And it's pretty exciting, especially his interactions with the government specifically, as well as the academic level. And then on the practical level, just working so closely with not only small scale farmers, but mainly high acreage,
high dollar commercial farms.
Yeah.
Commodities, right?
Absolutely.
One of the favorite segments for me was the historical portion where he kind of got to do a deep dive in a research project out east.
Yeah.
Ooh, that will get your attention, science dorks out there. Also history buffs, because he helped with some retrieving and evaluating of soil samples from Thomas Jefferson's old farm and George Washington's farm. Apparently all of our founding fathers of America did farming, because he also mentioned Monroe, Madison. So just kind of tapping into some of the soil integrity issues on those grounds that those famous names have used. So that was a really neat dive for me. I enjoyed that. And I would say definitely listen in. Those guys were a little bit advanced for their time, but it didn't come to them instantly. He kind of explained how land was so affordable back then that when they felt like their crops weren't growing well anymore, they would move to new land and start farming that and leave the depleted grounds behind. Quite interesting. That is not easy for us to do today. Nobody can afford an acre. So they did eventually incorporate some cover crops to help add nutrients, bring some probably biodiversity and microbiomes back into that upper level of the soil and improve the spectrum of health in their dirts. And they're able to, you know, farm another season. So kind of neat to hear that there were advanced things happening.
Yeah, they obviously didn't know directly about the microbiology and impacts, but they did know the results. And like, hey, if we plant these cover crops, we could have another season.
We don't have to move in 10 years.
Right. Exactly. Which is pretty neat. So yeah, looking forward to the interview. And
yes, please stay tuned.
So grab a cup of coffee or your favorite vanilla milk latte and let's get growing.
Appreciate your time. Let's just get into it. You actually grew up in, a family farm in Illinois. Is that correct?
Yes, I grew up on a family farm in central Illinois where we raised corn, soybeans, and wheat when I was young. And that was kind of what sparked my interest in agriculture growing up on the farm, and then went on to study it for graduate school and get a PhD studying crops and soils of all things, and kind of went from there. So
instead of applied route to being a farmer, like your father or grandfather?
Both my grandfathers were farmers. My great-grandfather.
Okay.
Native farmers going backwards, and my parents farmed their whole lives. And so, yes, I and my sisters deviated from that path. But I like to say I have farmed in a nonprofit fashion for a long time, either at university or otherwise.
Absolutely. What was it about, I guess, seeing your father, grandfather planting wheat, going through that whole process of, I guess, specifically soil health? I mean, how did you get into that niche?
For me, one thing that I was interested in from a young age is what the land had been like before white people started farming it. And so I've always had an interest in how the Native Americans responded to their environment, grew food, used the land, what was growing from a native standpoint on the land in terms of, I grew up in an area that was definitely prairies for thousands of years. We know about the impact of the glaciers, but we actually had on our farm kind of an unusual feature. It was a very flat part of central Illinois, but we had a 100-foot tall mound that was one of these glacial canes where the glacier just dumped a bunch of gravel and created what looked like a miniature mountain right on our farm. And so that kind of sparked my interest in the role of time and glaciers and formation of prairies and all that. So you learn when you're farming in that area about the impact of those geological forces and the force of the glacier on creation of the soil and the windblown soil, what we call loess. So all that got me interested in soils and how different plants influence the soils. And so today, when we look about soil health, we think, how did the prairies respond and impact the soil? And we know diversified plants were good for the soil. It helped feed soil microbial communities. And so a lot of those things that date back to how soils formed are part of what we look at with soil health today.
That's really interesting. When I think of glaciers and glacier deposits, I'm from Michigan, so I go to like the Sleeping Bear Dunes, the sand dunes, and there's a number of dunes, and I guess those were originally glacier deposits. Would think less so in parts of Illinois, which you're mentioning. And then also with soil health, I jump to microbial interactions and less so the geologic influences. So that's pretty unique to understand. Like, is it the composites that have been deposited that really make up a fertile soil, or is it
those formations of soils over time, whether it was what we call alluvial soils, like you might have in the Mississippi or Missouri River Valley? Those alluvial soils are typically water deposited soils. You can have soils that form from bedrock. You can have windblown soils that are what I referred to as loess, which is much of the Midwest is got loess soils overlaying what were glacial soils, where the glaciers kind of ground up rocks and gravel into smaller pieces, including sand and smaller particles. So you get all these forces influencing it. But then when I was in graduate school, we learned about those physical forces. We learned about the chemistry of the soils. We did not learn much about the biology of the soils. And that's what's really changed in the last few decades since I was in graduate school, is we've learned a lot more about the biology of the soils. And even there's a historical component. So I mentioned how glaciers may have influenced prairies influenced the formation of these soils. Even the prairies had grazing animals. Of course, we think of the buffalo, but there were other grazing animals. And the manure, urine, and saliva from those grazing animals influenced the evolution of these bacteria, fungi, protozoa, nematodes, all kinds of organisms that are in the soil. And so today, when we have just a cornfield with no animals out there, it's a very different environment from the way those soil microbes evolve. So they don't tend to be as healthy of a soil community as what you'd expect. So it's kind of like when we were kids in grade school, we learned about the fish in the ocean, and they had plankton and little shrimp and fish eating shrimp and bigger fish eating fish. And And in the soil, it's a little harder for us to envision it because we can't see the fish like we can in the ocean. But so the thing we can see is like earthworms, but they're on a tablespoon of healthy soil, there can be more microbes than there are people on planet Earth, more than 8 billion microbes in a tablespoon of soil. And so there's this whole food web that happens in a healthy soil, and it's stimulated if we have grazing animals, if we have diverse plant communities growing on the soil. And so that's our challenge today in our modern era where we have these big fields of corn and soybeans, of wheat and cotton. How do we, in some way, create something that's more like a prairie or a forest?
One of the key, I guess, key interest areas that you had, was it the relationship with the land and indigenous people and how that relates to soil science at all? Or
yeah, just how the land formed. I mean, I mentioned that glacial mound. The town that I went to school in was called Blue Mound because of the blue flowers that grew on this glacial hill. And supposedly when the first white people came, there were Native Americans camped on that mound, probably because they had good views over the landscape for hunting game and other things. And it just all was part of my thinking growing up on the farm, and how do all these things happen over time that led us to this point. And my grandparents' generation, you asked about them, they had much more diversified farms than we do today. They would have not just corn and soybeans, but they'd have wheat and oats and alfalfa and other hay crops. And they had their own fruit orchards. They had large vegetable gardens. They usually had, both of my grandparents had dairy cows and pigs and chickens. And I don't think they had any sheep, but you know, they had, they could basically produce all their own food except for a few essentials like sugar and salt. And so it's, from their generation, my grandparents' generation, to my parents' generation, agriculture became much less diverse and much more focused on these big commodity crops. And so it's amazing how fast that happened. And today, with regenerative agriculture, we're talking about not so much how do we go back in time, but how do we farm in a way that reflects some of the benefits that came from those more diversified farming systems.
So was it roughly around the time of either, what, World War I or II? Is it industrialized fertilizers, the focus on?
World War II, yeah, it was, yeah, the development of nitrogen fertilizer was known before World War II, but it came much more economical after World War II because they used the same processes to develop bombs to, and even today, ammonium nitrate, which is one of the common nitrogen fertilizers, can be used to develop explosives. So World War II had a big impact not only on fertilizers, but some of the same chemistry work that they did during World War II helped them figure out how to develop modern herbicides and so on. So a lot changed after World War II. Before that, agriculture was, they were using cover crops and manure to improve the soil. And then after World War II, it started to become more of the chemical era of farming.
And you think it was also because people were scared of, they saw what happened during the Great Depression, poverty and lack of food, and then wanting to have more and more efficiencies, maybe just economies of having one crop and trying to have higher yields and just this great success with this new industrialized fertilizer, that polyfarming just went away or significantly reduced for the time being?
Yeah, modern fertilizer herbicide era made it easier for farmers to farm more land. And in farming, bigger farms, they became more specialized. They became experts at growing just a few crops instead of growing a wider variety of food plants. Maybe they'd produce just one type of livestock, such as hogs or cattle, instead of having a whole variety of livestock on the farm. And of course, in that process, the farms no longer were self-sufficient to feed themselves, unlike my grandparents' generation, where they could more or less feed themselves. So a lot did change. And in some ways, it made agriculture more efficient, but it also reduced some of the sustainability of farming when we adopted those practices.
And you mentioned regenerative agriculture, and I've been hearing that a lot more lately, which is a good thing. We've heard of organic and, of course, more traditional meaning post-World War II, I would say. But how would you define regenerative agriculture?
That's a question I get a lot since I direct a Center for Regenerative Agriculture at the University of Missouri. The first thing I would tell you is there is no commonly accepted definition of regenerative ag. It's still kind of coming together what people think it is. There's no government definition. There's no one definition all the universities agree on. And that's a little different than sustainable agriculture, which is a term that's been around for longer. I served as National Director of Sustainable Agriculture for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Earlier in my career, we actually had a government definition of what sustainable agriculture was. Regenerative agriculture, how I explain it to people, is it's not a one-sentence definition. It's more about what kind of outcomes do we want from our farming. So we want better soil health, like we've been talking about. We want increased biological diversity. So instead of just thousands and thousands of acres of nothing but corn and soybeans, we want to see cover crops out there. We want pollinator plantings. We want diversified conservation plantings with prairie plants where they can fit in. And we want integration of crops and livestock. And those create other beneficial outcomes then, like better water quality and less soil erosion and less environmental offsite issues. So we kind of talk about it in terms of those outcomes is one way we talk about regenerative ag. But if I had to give a really brief definition, I would say it's farming to have more resilient food systems that are improving soil health, improving biodiversity, making farms more resilient to a changing climate. Those are kind of some key aspects of regenerative agriculture.
So it's really expanding beyond what that traditional mindset. It's really looking at a systematic approach. Yeah, that's really interesting. And a lot of people, I mean, I'd hope would be more interested in this method going forward. What challenges do you see, whether it be education or application with regenerative practices?
There are a lot of farmers that are interested in regenerative agriculture. In fact, I would say farmers have been innovating more than like universities have on how to do regenerative farming. Some of the leading farmers have been really effective at experimenting and helping educate other farmers. So one of the challenges, though, still is if you talked about kind of the majority of farmers out there, it's not that they're uninterested in farming in a way that protects the environment, because they do want to be good stewards. Most farmers feel it's important to be good stewards of the land, but there definitely are barriers. So they may feel, first of all, it's an economic question. So if I adopt this practice, am I going to make less money this year or not? And even if they were willing to accept that, maybe the bank that gives them a loan to be able to farm that year to pay for their seed and fertilizer is not willing to let them dramatically change what they're doing. They may be concerned that it's going to have policy implications for them. Most farmers today that grow these larger row crops like corn, soybean, wheat, and cotton, they get something called crop insurance. So if there's a bad year from a weather standpoint, there is a policy, sort of like you buy an insurance policy in your house or your car, the farmer can buy a policy on their corn or wheat. And that way, if the weather leads to a significantly lower yield, that insurance policy will pay maybe not 100% of what they lost, but a significant portion of it. But those policies can be somewhat restrictive sometimes in what the farmer is able to do. Now, there have been some improvements over the last several years where the crop insurance policies have gotten more accommodating the farmers doing some of these practices. But so there's policy issues. There can be equipment issues. Maybe the equipment they have isn't quite right to do some of the more regenerative approaches or needs to be modified. But mostly it's, I think, kind of a familiarity. We all get comfortable doing things the way we're used to doing them, right? And that's true of farmers too. And they're busy and you're saying, why don't you try this other practice? And they're like, I don't have time to learn that. I know how to do it this way. I can do it this traditional way very efficiently. And you're wanting me to change what I'm doing. So we always encourage people, the farmers, to, many farmers have lots of fields they're doing. A field might be 40 acres or 20 or 80. Try one field. Just try this practice like cover crops or reducing tillage on that one field and get a little experience with it and see if you're comfortable with it. The good thing for farmers today is there is a lot of financial support for them to try some of these practices. Much of it is through the government, either the federal government or state government. In some cases, private companies like General Mills, Kellogg, PepsiCo, or Payne. Farmers to do these practices. Even clothing companies like Wrangler Clothing are paying farmers to do cover crops with cotton. So that's making it easier, and it is helping more farmers try some of these regenerative practices. And I think we're going to continue to see that going forward.
I mean, I know that there's a variety of different types of lentils, as well as chickpeas, and then also soy, I would, as I understand it, fixes nitrogen in the soil, or not the plant, but the rhizomes, the bacteria. But what about also like perennials? Like I heard of Kernza.
Yeah, so Kernza is considered a perennial grain. So that means we can plant it once and then keep harvesting it for many years, maybe even 15 or 20 years. Some people equate it to wheat. If you looked at a field of Kernza driving down the road, you might think it was a field of wheat. It's not the same plant as wheat, but they're both members of the grass family and they have more seed heads. It's really a type of what we call intermediate wheatgrass, but it is a plant through plant breeding that has been developed to have some nice characteristics. The idea of planting it once and then keeping harvesting, it's more like growing a prairie. So the soil is, other than the first time you plant it, not disturbed. Soil erosion is greatly reduced. One really nice thing with Kernza is there's a really deep root system. The roots, depending on the soil type, can go 10 or even 15 feet deep in the soil, whereas regular wheat that's an annual crop planted every year, its roots may only go 3 or 4 feet deep. So it has some nice traits. Unfortunately, the yields are not as high as regular wheat. It does have good nutritional characteristics, but the biggest challenge is just it's a big change in management for farmers. We need more varieties and we need more people to figure out how to use it, more food companies. So it's been used a little, but it's like 1/100,000th of what the wheat acre is. There's a few thousand acres of Kernza, but there's 30, 40 million acres of winter wheat out there. So,
and then when you're rotating, I guess, let's say you have a fallow, it's called fallow, right? A field that
when you're not growing anything for a year, that would be considered a fallow system, which we see in the West. Now, not so much the Midwest where I'm at, but they do it in the West because anytime a crop is grown, it uses some of the soil moisture. And of course, they don't get a lot of rain in parts of Montana, Wyoming, Utah. So they'll grow a crop every other year and then in many of those areas, and then they will have a year where nothing is growing and they let the rain accumulate some soil moisture so they have a better chance of growing a crop. So that's called a wheat fallow system where they do that type of every other year planting.
Okay. And then what are in the Midwest are the main cover crops? Is like buckwheat or alfalfa? What are the main cover crops?
Yeah, there's a lot of different things used as cover crops. And basically, for your listeners, cover crops are plants used to protect and improve the soil, especially when no other plant or crop is being grown. So if you think of corn or soybeans, we see those driving through the Midwest in the summer, but they're, of course, harvested in the fall, and then nothing is grown until the next spring. So what we typically do with cover crops is we plant them in the fall, either right before or after the corn and soybeans are harvested, and then we let them grow all fall through the spring. And so they're holding the soil in place. And very importantly, as living plants, they're providing food to that soil microbial community at times when the soil would otherwise be bare or at least nothing growing. And they provide a lot of environmental benefits for water quality, putting carbon into the soil, which helps with greenhouse gas mitigation. It also helps farms adapt to changing climate, either droughts or big rainfalls. So these cover crops are valuable. So there's about 40 different species being sold in the U.S. today. The most common one is cereal rye. Other common ones are like crimson clover in the southern half of the United States. Hairy vetch is another one. Radishes, oats, even winter wheat can be a cover crop. So a cover crop is not being harvested normally for its seed. It's just being grown to protect and improve the soil and helps with other things like controlling weeds as well.
So, I mean, from an economic standpoint, what would be the advantage to a farmer of planting a crop as sort of like a holding?
That you're not harvesting.
Right. Thing, yeah, right.
This cover crop. So this is the question farmers that are not yet using cover crops ask. It's like, I'm going to have to pay like $30 an acre for this cover crop seed. I don't have $30,000 to plant 1,000 acres of cover crops. So again, the government is providing payments to help farmers try cover crops for a few years. That's really helping. The economic advantage is usually after 2 or 3 years, the yields start to get better in the fields that have cover crops. The rain soaks into the soil better, and that helps the crop like the corn and soybean grow better. They can also help with the fertility of the soil over time. They help control the weeds. So there are some other benefits, like maybe needing to spray less herbicides to control weeds. It's not that you can eliminate them necessarily, but the cover crops can help with the weed control. Some farmers will take cattle or other livestock like sheep and graze the cover crops late in the fall. After the corn's been harvested, they grow the cover crops for a month, and then they can go out there and graze them with the cattle, and then they can graze them again in the spring. And that really makes the cover crops pay off economically. And then they can do other things, like if the soils have been compacted from heavy equipment like combines harvesting the crop, they can help loosen up the soil. So they do pay off. We found we did a big national study on the economics of cover crops, and they typically pay off in 3 years, although they can pay off faster if they're grazed, for example.
Okay. And so similar, I wonder if like beekeepers rent out their bees to pollinate orchards. But if a farmer were to not have cattle or not have hogs.
Yeah, they can rent out that cover crop for grazing. Some are doing that. We've got hundreds of farmers that will do that to a neighbor that does have cattle, or they'll say, hey, I've got these cover crops. If you'll pay me for the time that you're grazing them, that can work to both farmers' advantages.
And then what about farms near, I don't even know if the farms near watersheds or let's say near rivers, would there be an higher incentives through the government to facilitate cover crop usage?
There have been in some areas. There are usually what we call watershed programs, where when we think of all the water that flows into a particular river or stream, if that is a stream that or river that has real problems, maybe there's been nitrates or phosphorus in that stream or pesticide issues, there may be a program either through a local conservation district or state government to particularly pay farmers in that watershed to use cover crops. But cover crops have gotten so popular as far as the benefits that they're providing that now we're seeing more statewide and national programs. So in most cases, it's not limited to a particular watershed. You can use them anywhere, but we do still see some programs that provide farmers. This is a really critical watershed, so let's use them here.
Yes, I mean, right now, I mean, we're located near the confluence, what is it, the Mississippi, Missouri, and Illinois River?
Illinois, yeah, we're all near St. Louis, yeah.
Right, and I mean, we've heard of, a lot of people have heard of the dead zone coming out of the Gulf, and is it Louisiana area?
Yeah, in the Gulf of Mexico, it's the nitrates that go into the Mississippi River system, including the Missouri River, and go down to the Gulf of Mexico. And what those nitrates do is the nitrate itself is not toxic to the fish, but what happens is it reduces the oxygen level through a chemical reaction in the Gulf of Mexico. And those reduced levels of oxygen then are what kill the sea life, including shrimp and fish and other creatures that are in. And they don't do it for the whole Gulf of Mexico. It's more near the mouth of the Mississippi River, but it's an area that changes in size somewhat each year, covers several hundred square miles. And so it has a big economic impact for the fishermen. And for that reason, there have been a lot of programs in the Mississippi watershed, which is like half of the continental U.S. is in that watershed, to try to reduce the level of fertilizers used, and even more importantly, the level of the nitrates that leave a field and then start going through streams and rivers down into the Mississippi River. So you can cover crops, reduce tillage, the way we apply the fertilizer, all those things can have a very positive impact on reducing those nitrates getting to the Gulf of Mexico.
Appreciate the insight there. You started with insight into the history of the land, the native indigenous folks, our usage. It seems like you do have an interest in historical farming. I did see somewhere that you had an interest with Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, their historical approaches. Did they use cover crops in there?
They did. That's a cool, it's a neat story. Cover crops are not a new idea. The Romans used them a little bit. They were used some historically in Europe, not necessarily on every farm, but before we developed fertilizers in the 1940s, you either had to put on animal manure or a legume cover crop like a clover were your only ways of improving the fertility of the soil. So both Thomas Jefferson and George Washington did use cover crops extensively, and they didn't just use them themselves. They strongly promoted them to other farmers because in their era, I actually spent some time a year ago in the fall doing a fellowship research project with these presidential estates. Particularly, I was staying at Thomas Jefferson's presidential estate, Monticello, and I took soil samples from Jefferson's farm and George Washington's farm,
oh, wow,
Monroe's farm and Madison's farm. It was a really fun project. And looking at kind of the health of soil. For the bad news is their farms today, most of their topsoil is gone. We don't know for sure how much of that happened when they were farming or in the 200 years since then, probably some of. But they recognized that they needed to use things like cover crops to keep their soil in place and improve its fertility, because what their neighbors were doing, kind of keep in mind, this is a time when people were, we had that vast American forest that, where squirrels could go from the Atlantic Ocean all the way to the Midwest without ever touching the ground. And so they were cutting down trees, of course, to be able to farm. And it was kind of what today we would call slash and burn if we were talking about tropical agriculture. So they were cutting down the trees. And for a brief period, the soil would be pretty fertile. But then within 10 to 15 years, the fertility would start to decline pretty significantly. And what a lot of Jefferson and Washington's peers were doing is they would just go a little further west and get new land because land was incredibly cheap and start farming it and abandoning the land that they had had. And maybe somebody else would come in and farm it that didn't have as much money, but you know, they just used up the fertility and they moved. So Jefferson and Washington were like, we don't need to do this. We can maintain the fertility of the soil by using these cover crops, keep it from washing away. And so they were always writing to each other and other farmers about the different cover crops they were trying. And in their own way, they were trying to be sustainable farmers. Now, there you could talk about big issues from a society standpoint with slavery that they depended on. That was the very negative aspect of the way they farm. But in terms of farming practices, they were thinking about crop rotation, cover crops, using manure effectively. So they were pretty innovative in that regard and trying new ways to farm.
And this is all before the deep understanding of the relationship with microbial or microorganisms in the soil. But it just was apparent that you have to have more inputs to produce or to continue to produce an output of whether it be tobacco or I don't know what other core crops were.
They were growing tobacco, corn, wheat were three of the biggest crops in that part of Virginia at the time. And they did grow some other things too, but including they had orchards and vegetable gardens and so on. But the big crops were wheat, corn, and tobacco for them. And they did recognize that things like clover or other legumes could help improve the fertility of the soil. They didn't know why, you're right, because they didn't have microscopes and things like that. They recognized there was a relationship there.
And good observations, good science. So that's outstanding that they made notes and sort of passed that information along to other farmers in the area and other, I guess, with the expansion of information, that migrated as well.
Yeah, they were very experimental. They both had experimental gardens where they would try different types of plants and, like I said, were writing letters to each other about what they learned. They also corresponded, especially George Washington, with farmers in England, which was kind of ironic that here we had just fought the War of Independence with England. And literally, right after the war is over, Washington's writing to these various English farmers about, how do you do your farming?
Right.
So it was pretty interesting.
So you've played a significant role in shaping agricultural policy, particularly in around soil health and conservation. How has this conversation around regenerative agriculture evolved in Washington, D.C.?
Let's start with soil health. There are so many aspects of our political system now where, of course, people are agreeing. There are extreme viewpoints on either side, and that's been true in agriculture, too. You think of like genetically modified crops or organic agriculture, where you get strong viewpoints on either end. I hate to say it, but climate change has been controversial in agriculture, too. But one thing that has not been controversial is soil health. So the good news there is that regardless of people's political persuasion, they've been able to agree that trying to improve soil health is important. Now, the reason I start there rather than regenerative ag is whereas there are quite a few like congressional staffers that have heard about soil health and understand it, I actually was part of a congressional staffer briefing with Tim Walz. He came in. He was chair of the House of Agriculture Subcommittee on Conservation at the time when he was a congressman, and we had a congressional briefing for staffers called The Love of the Soil because it was on Valentine's Day. Well, and he came in, by the way, and talked very knowledgeably about soil health. But anyway, most staffers are not very familiar with regenerative agriculture. So I would say it's not that there's big political opposition to it. It's just people are less familiar with the term. Now, The ones that have read about it a little, I think for the most part are okay with it, in part because we have a lot of our big food and agriculture companies are really pushing to do more regenerative agriculture. So regardless of whether you're Republican or Democrat, if you see General Mills and Kellogg's and Archer Daniels Midland and Cargill and all these big food and ag companies say, we're trying to push regenerative ag, then I think you say there must be something good about it.
Yes, yeah.
Tend to go along with it. So.
No, that's fascinating. So finding basically common ground, which would be soil health, and then going outward from there.
Yeah.
I guess further educating on the regenerative side. Yeah, the economics work, and there's products to be, it's a win-win for everything, then why not?
Yeah, now having said all that, we are in a time when we need to pass a new farm bill. The farm bill is something passed
expired,
every 5 years. Yeah, and it's expired. Just here in September, it expired, and they did not manage to pass a new one before it expired. But I don't think we're going to see a lot of language around regenerative ag in the farm bill. There will be some on soil health. There was some on soil health in the last farm bill. But there has been an effort at the U.S. Department of Agriculture to put more resources into this. The Inflation Reduction Act actually included a lot of programs related to soil health and regenerative ag under the banner of what is called climate smart agriculture, which includes things like cover crops, agroforestry, different grazing practices, more efficient fertilizer use. So there's a lot of projects going on that. We have a big one we're leading in the state of Missouri on climate smart agriculture. And so a lot of these things are connected together.
And that's probably touches on technology too, whether it be targeting weeds with little robots and zappers, or I don't know, just something. I mean, that might be too far in the future, but
technology is always changing farming, just like every sector of our economy. But two of the newer things we're seeing that are kind of fun from a technology standpoint is the cover crops I've been mentioning. One of the challenges for farmers is to get them seeded because the farmers are busy in the fall harvesting and doing other things. And so we're starting just in the last 2 years to see companies providing drones that can go out and fly over the crop field and spread cover crop seed even before like the corn is harvested, so it can start growing while the corn is being harvested. So that's kind of been interesting to see the use of drones for that. I think it'll be a while, like maybe a decade or more, before the drone used really widely in seeding cover crops, but they're starting to be used. Another on the livestock side, a project that we're working with is called virtual fencing. So many people are familiar with having a collar with your dog and an underground buried wire that keeps the dog in the yard without having to have a physical fence. It's sort of similar to that, except with a cow or sheep or goats, you're not burying a wire around the perimeter, but they are wearing a special collar that when they get to the edge of where they're supposed to be grazing, it produces an auditory noise like do-do-do-do-do, and they learn they need to turn around. If they keep going, depending on the technology, they'll either get a vibration or a shock, and they pretty quickly learn to just turn around when they hear that noise. And the nice thing with that is you can, on your phone, tablet, or computer, you can redraw each day the area they're supposed to be grazing, so they're moving more intensely across the area to be grazed in the way that like buffalo did, where they graze very intensely in a spot and then kind of keep moving. It's very different from the way much cattle grazing is done in Midwest, where they're put out on their pasture for the whole summer. And although that is okay in some respects, it doesn't mimic the way the natural grazing happened. And so when the farmers start using this more intensive grazing, which is easier with this virtual fencing, they tend to see native prairie grasses and flowers starting to come back without even planting them. The soil health seems to be better. It's a little more economically beneficial. But the challenge has been farmers to do that with regular fencing. You have to go out and move like electric strands of wire every day. And some are willing to do that, but many are not. With this virtual fencing, it really reduces that labor. Now, there's a cost, of course, to buy these collars, and we need to see if economically this is going to work out. So we have a project to help farmers try that out on farms in Missouri starting next year. So.
No, that's amazing. And that's a really good look into the future. I would say, are there any concerns about this technology adaptation? Are there like hurdles or barriers there besides the economics?
We have to be careful that you still have a physical fence near a busy roadway just in case the technology doesn't work. You don't want a cow wandering in front of somebody driving 60 miles down the road. And people are recognizing they need to do that. There's also kind of a question, again, of the economics. And I've had a couple people say, was that worse for the animal or not? They don't get shocked any more than they would with a regular electric fencing. In fact, there's a newer system that uses vibration with the sound, and they feel like the animals pretty much never get shocked, or maybe once a year or something. So there's the research that's been done so far shows that this is less stress for the animal using the virtual fencing, and it seems to work pretty well. And they don't put the collars, by the way, on like the young animals. They're kind of like teenagers. They're too headstrong anyway.
So, sure.
So you just put it on the mama cows, and the younger calves will stay near their mothers. So.
And then with all this information coming out, I mean, is there anything that can be gleaned for not only large-scale farming or even mid-scale, but some farmers around?
Yeah, with our Center for Regenerative Ag, we work pretty closely with some small farms, including urban farms that are maybe on a quarter acre. So some of the same things still apply, using cover crops, pollinators, trying to have healthy soil, even if it's a very small plot of land. We can, in some cases, integrate livestock into some of these smaller operations. People have mobile chicken coops where they'll move them around their property, and the chickens help eat the insects that would be pests and fertilize the soil. So there are some of the approaches that are scalable to different sizes of operations.
Oh, that's exciting. As a consumer, how can I influence, or is there any takeaways for the end user to search out in the marketplace?
We are seeing more products that are getting labeled as some aspect of regenerative ag. Now, you're probably not going to go in the grocery store and see 20% of the grocery store have regenerative ag on the label, but you will find a few products labeled that way. What you're a little more likely to see is related things. Obviously, organic ag is the food product label that we see most often, but you may see that it's produced in a more climate smart fashion, or that it's being produced in a way that lowers greenhouse gases or helps put carbon in the soil or has less water quality impact. So just paying attention to food labels and what you can find out about the food. Working with local farmers can be a good way to achieve some of these goals. So buying through a farmer's market, talking to the farmer, getting to know how they farm is helpful. It may be things other than clothing. It could be clothing, sustainable cotton. It could be other products coming from agriculture that you might find. So I think just kind of being aware of what you're buying and learning more about it, or if possible, buying from local farmers, all those things can be helpful.
That's exciting. I appreciate that. And then for the listeners, where can people find more information about, I guess, either programs or grant funding or regenerative agriculture? I guess that just the gamut there.
Yeah, we have on our website information for consumers as well as people that have rural land and farmers themselves. So if they just do a search for Center for Regenerative Agriculture and add the word Missouri, you'll find it, or say University of Missouri, Center for Regenerative Ag. And we've got quite a bit of information, including some videos of how farmers are doing these things, as well as articles and just general websites. So yeah, that'd be something to take a look at.
Dr. Myers, appreciate that. Is there anything else that we should touch on before we conclude the session here?
I would just reiterate, if people are doing their own backyard gardening, some of these things are relevant. You can try cover crops on your own farm, do some pollinator planting. So it isn't just something for a farmer with 1,000 acres. It could be for your own backyard garden to try some of these practices.
That's sort of like drops of water in a bathtub. If everyone does it, then the whole system will be improved.
Definitely.
Does your research, have you worked with chickpeas at all, or has that been out of scope?
I have grown chickpeas, not too recently, because I found that they don't do super well in Missouri.
Okay, all right, fair enough.
Chickpeas and lentils, as you, I'm sure, know, are Mediterranean crops that are in that area grown from the fall through the spring. But our winters are too cold to do it that way here, so we have to plant them in the early spring. And what I've found with chickpeas and lentils here in Missouri is they look great in April, pretty good in May, and not very good in June when it starts to get hot and humid, because they're a cool season plant. So that's why in the U.S., they're mainly grown in like the Pacific Northwest, where the conditions stay cooler for longer. And even when it does get hot, it's not so humid, so they don't tend to get some of the diseases that can show up on them here in Missouri in June as the seed are maturing. So you can grow, if somebody wants to grow them in their garden here, they can do it, but they're just going to see some diseases show up on the leaves and pods, and they're not going to be as high yielding as they would in Canada or the Mediterranean or the Northwest, so.
We have been sourcing our chickpeas from Montana. I think it's some farm collectives through Timeless Seeds or Timeless Foods. And I know that that's like a cooperative that does lentils, chickpeas, farro, and maybe spelt. I'm not sure. But
that's where most of them are grown, is the Pacific Northwest as far as U.S. continental production. So
perfect. Thanks so much. Appreciate your time.
Sure.
And we'll look forward to getting this out, and appreciate it.
Thanks for having me again, and very nice to connect with you.
All right. Have a good rest of your day.
You too. Take care.
We would like to thank Dr. Rob Myers, Director of the Center for Regenerative Agriculture at the University of Missouri, for joining us today. We have all learned quite a bit. You can find tons of information and additional valuable resources on the Center for Regenerative Agriculture website at cra.missouri.edu, or you can visit their Facebook page at Mizzou Center for Regenerative Ag, just to learn more. This is Tangled Taproot, a production of Milk and Hummus. I'm Kristen.
I'm John Cowan.
And I'm Jackson.
If you like what you listened to today, please like, share, and leave us a review. Again, thank you so much for listening. Send us a message, share your feedback, send your thoughts to TangledTaproot at milkandhummus.com. We would love to answer your questions on the next podcast. Thanks so much. See you next time.